Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we're having lunch with Chris Gregson. Chris, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Before the show, we were talking about your interest in weapons of mass destruction. So I what are you doing with that?
Well, what I learned is on the emergency side, the actual event, and when the different organizations are called together, you know, if the police are contacted first, and how they organize to deal with the situation from the planning and operations. That's
right,
what they deal with.
Right.
So it's actually pretty interesting.
Yes, and but has nothing to do with what we were here to talk about.
No, absolutely nothing.
Tell me a little bit. Well, actually, for those of you who are actually still listening, Chris is an artist, and as you know, this show comes on every week, and we talk to artists about their work and their creative process. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background?
I'm an abstract painter, but I wasn't always an abstract painter, so that's what I do now. I have been an artist now for many years, over, well, I think since I was a little kid, I was always an artist, so, you know.
When did that start? When you were...
After
7, 8 years old.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, I actually, I was an actor when I was 7 or 8 years old. My brother was a director. My older brother was a director and screenwriter, and then I was usually the main character in all his 8mm films. So,
do you still have the film?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh. I'm sorry, this is radio.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess it's...
I mean, because your first love was theater.
Right. My first love was theater, and I went to New York, and I did theater. And I worked in many different capacities. I worked on lighting. I worked in stage management, and I worked on stage painting, and
were
I did stage
performer,
designer.
Ever?
Not... No. By the time I graduated,
Do you know why? Why would you go from being a performer to being more technical?
It was probably at the time it was practical. I just didn't have the depth that an actor needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I was.
I mean,
very
you really
limited.
Came to that understanding at that young an age.
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, because by that time, I had been performing pretty regularly since. 8th grade.
Right.
So it was 6 years, 6-7 years of not only doing high school productions, but by that time I was doing summer stock and that type of thing. So, you know, I felt it was sort of over for me, and I was looking in a different direction. But my foundation was theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always using the narrative and as a foundation for my artwork or for my inspiration. So, but, you know, I drew from a lot of different things. I was very inspired by cartoons, especially the New Yorker cartoons. If you really look into the depth of their work, you can – there's a lot of depth. Saul Steinberg was absolutely amazing, and he was dealing with he was dealing with a sort of a postmodernistic process before postmodernism was even discussed, and I found that fascinating. I found that he was drawing from the past, and he was looking at things from multiple sides. The techniques that these artists use were absolutely incredible. And while I was living in New York, I could actually see show after show after show of the original sketches that these artists actually had done. So you would see how they would apply their watercolors and their inks and
which
how
artist? You talking about cartoonists?
Yes, I'm talking about cartoonists.
Really? Interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, okay, so that influenced your work.
Mm-hmm.
How did that move you forward?
Well, it moved me forward because having no training, I wanted to move into materials that I was familiar with. And as a stage designer, I was familiar with pencils, pens, and watercolor.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing what the cartoonists could do helped me think things through using those medias. And so I was automatically drawn to other artists
mm-hmm.
of who also use those medias. And I think Paul Klee was obviously the one that
right.
made my connection to the art world.
Mm-hmm.
So then I started working in those mediums, such as pen and ink and watercolor, and then moved on, you know, started working in acrylic and then finally oil.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was a step-by-step process and getting more and more elaborate all the time with the medium.
So there was a time where you were involved as a performer, which was relying on your own sort of ability to take someone else's words and reflect it and express it in a creative way. And then there was a time where you moved more into the technical end,
mm-hmm.
which obviously requires a certain amount of creativity and technical ability.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've sort of splintered off into a third area of making your own art.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that art. What was that? What were you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Were these idea-driven things? Were these driven through emotion? Were these
mm-hmm.
What was the impetus?
I liked the narrative of the theater, so I always wanted to sort of do that type of thing. So I was really, really playing off of many, many, many different influences. So sometimes I would be doing abstraction. Sometimes I would be doing imagery that would look like, you know, Milton Avery, because mm-hmm. I thought his colors were incredible. So basically, it was basically a learning experience for me at first, and mm-hmm. experimental. It didn't really come in. I didn't really have my own voice for a while, and even at the time, there were so many different ways of going with your art. There was less of a need to have a signature style. I believe I would see very many artists working in different directions, and things like people just wouldn't put signatures on the front of their work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your work could look like anything. Your signature wasn't important to be consistent. There was no need to be consistent. So I worked in many different ways. But I guess the culmination of my work, the first culmination of my work, was really a thing I did at now the defunct Franklin Street Gallery, mm-hmm. where I did this thing called Artaud, and it was a narrative. And I set it up. It was a weird experience because I was working in the studio in a very chance, random way. So I was just going about the painting process, and I had this show deadline. So I kept on painting and painting and painting, thinking that I would have a room full of independent pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But after I had done all this work, I saw a thread in them. It was semi-representational imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that I would set it up almost like a Stations of the Cross, which, you know, I was Catholic, and that sort of religious right. framing of your work was interesting. It also was a narrative in the sense that it went from step to step to step to step. It was like the cartoons. It also told a story like the theater. And so I set it all up, and then I did a storyline and connected all the pictures. So it had a beginning, it had a middle, and an end. So it was very much based on the foundations of my learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
And in reflection, it was really about the self. The Artaud narrative was about the self. So it was very psychological. I did a video and blah, blah, blah. So that was really the sort of the beginning and the end of my relationship with theater and all my old school learning experiences. After that exhibit, I wanted to move on into something new, something that wasn't based on all these foundations.
Right, right.
And that's what I did. Then I went into abstraction. I did the new name show at 1708, mm-hmm. and that was my first step into the world of abstraction.
What was going on inside of you? I mean, this was a pretty big transition for you, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Is there something you can talk about that was going on inside of you?
For me, it was very simple. It feels like I knew I was in such a routine, you know. I knew that this meant this, that this meant that, that if I do this, this is that. Okay. So everything was predictable.
Right.
And I wanted to sort of get to a new place. I wanted to see things from a new perspective. Mm-hmm. And basically that's the reason why I wanted to do it. I wanted to open my head up to something new. I wanted the inside to...
Do you find that a part of your process as an artist through your whole life? That there is this learning process, learning how to do things, mm-hmm. mastering them, becoming comfortable with them, and then almost feeling hemmed in by them, and then wanting to move to something else? Is that a...
Yeah, you always want to get outside of the box.
Yeah.
Always. I mean, that's for me is a big thing. You know, mm-hmm. once the box is created, I want to get outside.
Right. It's interesting. Yeah. How many boxes have you created in your life, do you think? How many times have you had that happen where all of a sudden you realize that what you're doing and the way you're doing it has reached a certain limit, and in order mm-hmm. to continue, I guess, this creative journey, you've got to mm-hmm. do something else. And when you get to that point, mm-hmm. is it scary? Is it interesting? Is it challenging? Is it... Do you feel like there are no more boxes? Maybe this is the last box, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm. I'm always doing that, even when I'm in the box. You start this experimentation that may take you into a new place. And initially, I would do that all the time. I would always try to push it a little bit. And I would destroy a lot of work, you know. Mm-hmm. I would say at one point, I don't feel this way now, but not too long ago, I would say that if I could create one good piece per year, I've accomplished something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, out of the whole process, you know, there would be the ideal piece. It would have mm-hmm. the optimum, you know. It was right there. It just hit the mark. And then from that, you build up to that, and then you're always going away from that.
Right.
After that. So
how do you know when you get to that? I mean, how do you know when you've got the optimum piece?
It works. Artist, it's one thing, and for the viewer, it's probably another.
Uh-huh.
But usually, if you're in a room full of artists, you know, That's the reason why you come up with that term. Oh, that's an artist's piece,
right?
You know,
artists can relate to that.
Yeah, artists,
right?
You know, they know. So you know, that's for me the optimum.
So the optimum for you is if you make the piece and other artists really resonate to it, then you've accomplished something.
Yeah, because we're in the same club. Yeah, yeah.
So where does that leave the viewer?
Well, that, you know, the viewers can, some of those viewers are artists.
Right.
But the viewers may not see the faults that the community of artists might see.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it may be a beautiful, beautiful picture for whatever reason. But it may fail on some sort of artistic level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just because.
So the public might see a beautiful picture, whereas other fellow artists might see this as not having achieved its
mm-hmm.
its whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of criteria is used, do you think, to make those decisions? I mean,
I don't know. I just remember that when I had a show in 1993, and I was at 1708, and I was mm-hmm. showing with Stephen Kushner, a DC artist, and Davey Dett Thompson and Howard Rosati came to my show, and I talked to Davey Dett after, And they, all they discussed was the failure of the edges.
Really?
Yeah. The edges failed. And I knew absolutely what they meant by that.
Now, what did
that's
they
not
mean
something
by that?
Well, there's, you know, you have this picture,
mm-hmm.
and it's in this space,
mm-hmm.
and the after that, it's like a proscenium. Here I go back to the theater imagery.
Right.
Outside the proscenium, you know, you have to make it work all the way out.
The whole
to
thing's
got
to work to the edge, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so they were having problems with whatever you'd done on the edge.
Right.
How'd they feel about the rest of it?
I don't know. I have no idea. That's the only thing I remember.
They just
I still remember
about the
it to this day.
Of the edge.
The edges and edges are always extremely important to me. I mean, you go to a museum sometime or watch people look at art, and you'll get these artists that will not look at the art straight on.
Right.
They'll go off and look at it on a diagonal.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they're checking out the edges. They're checking out the surfaces. I mean, you know, that's the way artists are.
Uh-huh. Talk about surface a little bit. Because, as much as we've done on this show, I don't know that I've ever really had this conversation with an artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, I mean, about, you know, the whole thing. Just first of all, what does surface mean to someone who doesn't know? I mean, artists talk about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not an artist, it's like... So let me see. So you spend your life's energy concerned with the surface and the edges. I mean, it sort of goes right past people. Why are those things important?
Well, a simple analogy, once again, another simple analogy is patina. You mm-hmm. know, why does somebody want to buy a mahogany dining room table, and why does somebody want to buy a shaker dining room table, and why does somebody want to buy a country
mm-hmm.
kitchen table? I mean, they all have a different patina and surface. They evoke
right.
certain emotions. And that's the same thing with an artist's surface.
Hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that's the
when
craft
When you say
part.
Surface, are you talking about the texture of it? Are you talking about the color? Or are you talking about...
I'm talking about it all.
All
I
of
mean,
it.
Surface is surface.
Surface is all of
the
it together.
The way that all that works together, you know.
I mean, don't all paintings have the same surface? I mean, you walk in and you see an oil painting,
no.
and
No. I mean, does you know? I try to make this as easy as possible to understand, but you know, what's the difference between an oil finish
mm-hmm.
on a piece of furniture and a polyurethane? It's a completely
right.
different surface,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and it evokes a different visceral response,
right. okay.
and that's the whole thing that painting should do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, you look at somebody
so
like
So it's something
Tuttle.
above and beyond the actual content of the painting.
Mm-hmm.
It's a totally separate
mm-hmm.
issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And look at
but an issue that a lot of people looking at paintings might never even notice. Walking into a museum, they're looking at the imagery. They're looking at the... Right?
They are, but consciously or unconsciously, they are looking at the surface.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a simple thing, though, to understand. I mean,
how important is that in your work?
Oh, it's very important.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the. For me, that's part of the craft.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way I approach it as a craft.
Is do you have any kind of ritual that you use to get started in the studio? I mean, do you find it hard to get into the studio? To, you know, like most people, I think you can relate to the. In a crude sense of getting to the gym every day or getting to the gym three or four times a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people have a sort of a ritual, you know, where they just do these things in order to get themselves
right.
there.
Right.
Is there anything like that in your work?
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you
I
do?
I mean, I think, yeah, yeah.
I mean,
well,
to get
I'll
over
do
the
different
hump.
Things. Yeah, you know, you have to clear your head
mm-hmm.
In order to work in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
My studio... Any artist that's working pretty continually will have all, well, I don't know, but I do. I have mm-hmm. everything set up in the studio. So when I get into the studio, there's really nothing I have to do. I don't have to clean my brushes or
so
anything.
So that's important.
Like that.
So they have that
yeah,
all set
everything's
up.
Ready to go
ready to
when
go.
I get
okay.
into the
right.
the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So
I mean,
that,
do you play loud music? Do you?
Well, no. Well, first of all, I have to clear my head. So either
huh.
in the morning, before I go out to the studio, I'll straighten things up just all around me in order to have some sort of sense of order, or I'll have breakfast, or I'll just work in the garden for a little bit, and then I'll go out to the studio, and I do listen to music, and I do sometimes I'll just have the radio on, and then sometimes I'll listen to music.
But there is a certain sort of ritual to this. You don't just wander into the studio and start making art.
No, definitely I have to clear my head. I have to clear my head. I have to open it up. It's almost like, you know, getting ready for the big race. You have to sort of get geared up for it. Mm-hmm. And that gear up is not a competitive thing.
No.
No, it's not getting up for the big race and the competition. It's more of a relaxing, more experience. You know, they say that your best dreams are right at... Well, I mean, your best thoughts come to you right before you're going to go to sleep.
Right.
And in some ways, you know, you have to get to that point where your mind is open to what is going to come. You can't
so it's
be
a different
distracted.
Kind of... it's a different world than the world you make a living in, or... Is it a different world in the studio for you?
Different world. A different world. I don't know. I mean, it's part of the world. It's a part of my world.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something outside of my world.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, you have to bring your world into it. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, just, I bring my world into it. Yeah, I do.
No matter where you go, there you are.
Yeah, right. It's always been part of my world. I mean, you know, once
what about doubt and fear? Are those...
And fear.
Yeah. I mean, when you're in there, you ever, you know, sort of thinking to yourself, you know, this work I'm doing has been done before, or I have nothing really to say, or, what am I doing this for? Does that ever creep into your head while you're in there? Wailing away? Or do you have supreme self-confidence?
You know, I've worked through that. No,
have you?
I've worked through a lot of the
How'd you work through it?
Just keep doing it.
Uh-huh.
You just keep doing it. And you get to a point where you don't feel like you need to justify it anymore. You realize that this is what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And then people, you know, people are either going to accept it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've gone many, many, many years without a lot of validation going on.
Right.
But as long as you, I mean, a validation that I would, I felt that was, you know, pushing me a little bit forward in some ways. But I've always gotten enough validation that I've wanted to stick with it. So what was the fear and what was the other one?
Well, just sort of doubt.
Doubt.
You know, you're working in a society that generally doesn't validate most artists. And you're also doing something where, you know, that old thing of facing as a writer, a blank sheet of paper, or as an artist, a blank canvas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of, it's easier, I think, to just sort of throw your hands up and say, well, I'm never going to be Picasso. I'm never going to, you know, what am I doing here? Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's really ever probably going to look at this all that much. You know.
I don't think about those things.
Is that really?
That's depressing. No, I don't.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't let my head go too far down that road because... Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, I kind of like set my goals. There's a whole balance thing, and you have to set your goals, and you have to have a good life. And, you know, that's where I want to be. And I find a lot of, I don't know, what I'm doing is right, and I have to do it. And that's the way it is. There is a lot less fear. going on.
As you've gotten older.
As I've gotten older. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the competition is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're really looking at it from a competitive point of view, it's amazing. I mean, every day I'll look and see billions of artists out there doing
right.
things and saying like, wow, that's a lot better than me and everything.
So if it's not about getting that kind of validation, if it's not about making money, what's it about?
Well, it is about getting that kind of validation. It is about making money.
Uh-huh.
But it's also, I know that there's a basic drive in me to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't do that, then I'm not happy. I'm not fulfilled. I'm not one.
Right.
You know? I mean, there was a great show on the radio, on the television about, you know, trying to figure out why people did the cave paintings initially. And
hard to figure out since they're no longer here. But
right. And it was very difficult. But you know, there's lots of people there.
That's a great show. I got to see that.
It was a great show. But, you know, basically.
But it's a great question. And that's what I'm asking you. Why cave paintings? Really? I mean, that's the ultimate nobody's ever going to see it, care
well,
about
I'll
it.
I'll tell
you. You know,
you
that's
know,
really great.
Well, you know, I really don't. I do my work. But let me just. 2 seconds on the cave painting. What the analysts thought initially was that they were defining hunting scenes, and they were just making a record of the hunting scenes. But actually, what they were doing, they determined, was that they were visions. They were visions of things unseen. They were mm-hmm. visions of animals that had spiritual powers. There were abstract forms in there that were from trances and that type of thing. So it was a vision of those things unseen. And I think that's what I do with my work.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
a vision of those things unseen?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really good. Yeah. I mean, I think everybody I've talked to has sort of talked around that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. When you ask them about, you know, I mean, you ask someone, why do you make art? And they just kind of blah, 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 blah. Fumble around for a while.
Right.
Why are you asking me that question? What do you mean, why do I make art? Isn't it obvious? Can't you tell by looking at my work?
Right. No, yeah. I think there's something.
There's something very, a vision of those things that are yet unseen, I think is probably pretty good. I might change the name of this radio show to that. Sort of stuck on that one. I kind of like that a lot. Well, listen, I'm afraid we're out of time here on Things Yet Unseen. And so we're going to have to close this. But thank you, Chris, very much. Thank you all for tuning in to Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you on the radio next Friday at 12:30. And once again, this is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's indie radio. It's radio for the rest of us.